Hi, this is Alan Shartok. Delighted to be in conversation with Mark Volpe, the managing director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Mark was recently named to the 237th class of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Other newly elected members included singer-songwriter John Legend, actress Carol Burnett, Harvard Law professor Jonathan L. Zittrain, and MIT Media Lab director Joy Ito. The new class will be inducted at a ceremony on October 7th in Cambridge. We'll talk to Mark Volpe about the honor, the symphony orchestra, and a lot more. But first, welcome my old frenemy, Mark Volpe.
Mr. Shartok, how are you?
Well, Mr. Volpe, I'm fine. It's always great to talk to you. And, you know, I love Tanglewood and I love the Boston Symphony. I really think the Berkshires are made because we have this thing. And you have made such a success out of it. And the only thing I'm going to say is that's the last nice thing I'm going to say to you on the air today.
Good to know.
But let me start by asking you, so what is this thing, the 237th class of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences? And how did they forget me?
Well, look, for me, it took 237 ballots to get me there. I think there were a few presidents during the century that got up to 100 ballots, but I'm not quite in that camp. I think it's, you know, how they forget you. That's not a punchline, right? Oops. Anyhow, no, it's an honorific society. They do good work in today's world, especially where think tanks and the actual, you know, thinking and intellectual pursuits are not quite candidly as respected as they once were. It's great to have this group there that commissions research and has fellows come from all over the world to, you know, usually issues of international significance, and whether it be health. And I think now they're starting to look at the role culture might play in civilization and civilizing society and all of that, not to be a tad grandiose. So I think looking forward to it. And there have been a few other BSO family members involved. I think Arthur Fiedler was a fellow, as was Aaron Copland. I think John Williams was recently inducted. So nice company to be associated with. And I suspect you will be at least in the class of 239 or 240. That's where the betting is right now, Alan.
Okay. Well, they know where to find me. So Mark Volpe, I know why they put you into this class, because you're better at your job than anybody else's. Hey, it's been a huge, long climb from being, you know, a third clarinetist in a third-rate orchestra to being the head of the most important orchestra in the world. And you've done it, and everybody knows it. It's extraordinary what you've done. Do you take any exception to the third clarinetist in the third-rate
orchestra?
No.
I mean, I think losing 17, 18 auditions is quite motivating. As I've shared, you know, I will tell you, I have such admiration for the people here who've proceeded through four or five rounds and have won auditions in the Boston Symphony. I will tell you, one of the life-changing moments for me was flying out to one of the big California orchestras, and you know how auditions work. You play little fragments, little 13, 15, 18, 25-second parts of each piece. And so I was playing my Beethoven 6th Symphony, and they said next. So I turned the page and started playing the Brahms, and they said, no, next. And
next.
At that point, I decided to go to law school. I mean, at that very moment, honest to God, I said this, because I think my net worth was about $612, and I spent like $508 to play for 45 seconds, you know. So,
were you married to Martha yet?
No.
Okay, so I know that Martha does not like me to mention her name on the air.
Too late.
Well, you haven't seen anything yet. Okay. Okay, so I guess the first question is, you went to law school. You gave me that lead. So tell me a little bit about what happens to a musician, a clarinetist, a good one, who goes to law school. Do you find other people who play instruments and get together, you know, and do sort of music together, chamber music, or is it all behind you then? You never look at another reed or another clarinet again for the rest of your life?
Oh, no. I actually went to the dean and asked to be able to get credit for playing clarinet and taking lessons. And so I played all through law school and played once, I think, or twice in Miss Orchestra and a few times in St. Paul and the Chamber Orchestra there and many other jobs. So it helped pay, you know, I mean, I can't imagine. Listen, I have two kids who just got through college. I got my entire law degree in state tuition at the University of Minnesota for under $6,000. You know, it was like $1,700 a year, you know. So I came out of law school, you know, with a car, with a condo, because I was making money playing professionally. And so I looked at a few, you know, big law firm jobs, and certainly have a great deal of respect for people who pursue that course. But I missed being around musicians and ultimately chose to take a job, as my father would tell you, 17 cents on the dollar.
So what exactly did you do? You graduate, you had the sheepskin. What do you do?
I graduated, and I was going to take the bar, and then I got a call from a guy who was running the Baltimore Symphony, and he said, come to Baltimore. I'd never been to Baltimore, and I interviewed, and I was interested. I'd written in law school, a whole series of articles that got some awards on collective bargaining in the orchestral setting, collective bargaining and equity in terms of the theatrical world, and wrote a lot about intellectual property matters, copyright and trademark and whatever. And so, certain areas I had some degree of familiarity, just enough to be dangerous. But ultimately, I applied I went to work for a big orchestra. So Baltimore certainly was a big orchestra, and I applied, and I mean, not Boston Symphony level, but still a very, very wonderful group of people. And I applied for the assistant executive director job. I was hired. And then the guy who was executive director said, I'm going in for major brain surgery. I'm going to be at Johns Hopkins for the next 7 months.
Wow.
So turned the keys over. I was 24. I don't even know if it was 24 or 25. And all of a sudden, without any experience and without any, any standing or without any sense of what to do, I got thrown into that. He did come back for a time being, but I was kind of sink or swim. And at that point, I was still playing a little bit. So I actually, and the personnel manager insisted, they hired me. I was not only, the general manager, whatever the title was, but I also was playing in the orchestra occasionally, especially in the summers. Speaking of third clarinet, I was the highest paid third clarinet because I was negotiating on both sides. I was negotiating as a musician. And I was negotiating as the manager. So somehow the musician was a much better negotiator. So I was, I think, triple scale. I'm teasing, of course. I basically donated all the money back to the orchestra. But, it was trial by ordeal. I had some very good friends in the orchestra that I went to school with at the Eastman School of Music and Indiana University, two big music schools. And had 10, 15 friends in the orchestra from school. And they pulled for me and counseled me, and a few other people, Mr. Meyerhoff, who gave the hall, gave the endowment, and a very, very prominent family. In fact, I can tell you what, first time I got to go to the White House was with Joe Meyerhoff, and it was right after, if you recall, when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, there was no cultural exchange. We didn't go to their Olympic Games in Moscow. They didn't come to ours in Los Angeles. And so at that point, Reagan and Bush, this is 86 and 87, decided, along with obviously the folks in Russia, to think about, thawing. Gorbachev was already ascent. It completed its ascent into power. And we were asked, the Meyerhoffs and I went to the White House to plead with the president. President Bush was also involved in this. Instead of the Boston Symphony, which was the orchestra that went to the Soviet Union in 1956, first American orchestra to play the Soviet Union, was the first orchestra to play China after the normalization of relations. So instead of the Great Boston Symphony or New York Philharmonic, how about Baltimore Symphony? And Mr. Meyerhoff, I was there when Mr. Meyerhoff, in a very cordial and very subtle way, reminded President Reagan that he was one of the first big Jewish Republicans to bundle and raise money, along with Max Fischer in Michigan, and that, not to suggest there was a quid pro quo, but no. He would be very much honored if Mr. Reagan would consider, instead of using, the Great Boston Symphony to re-enter the cultural exchange, world with the Soviets. At that point, there were still Soviets. And so got to experience that and organize a tour, and with, I guess, people you would know. And that Sarbanes came on that trip, Mikulski came on that trip, Governor Schaefer came on that trip, and NBC News. So it was a big deal for Baltimore.
Do you think when you eventually got to the Boston Symphony, they had their long memory, said you were a very attractive candidate because you had eaten their lunch on the reopening of the culture?
No, I think I think it was more what I did in Detroit. That was 86, 87. Who remembers that? Republicans always go back to the Reagan obvious decade or 8 years. But anyhow, no, I think it was, the first guy to call me in Boston was not one of the board chairs or one of the musicians. It was Yo-Yo. Had been to Detroit. What I did in Detroit wasn't about, having the world's greatest orchestra. Detroit, since 68 and 67, the riots, and Detroit never recovered. And the politics of race is so pervasive there and many other places as well. But we basically focused on urban development. So in my time there, we organized, and I didn't quite complete it, but we had about $250 million development around the hall. Yeah, we built an office structure. We built a 1,000-car deck. We built a $110 million performing arts high school, obviously with government money. I went to every school board meeting in Detroit for about a year and a half. In addition to that, we expanded the hall and did a few other things. So I think that got noticed. I got written up in the Times and the Journal and a bunch of other places. And I think that attracted the attention of not just Yo-Yo, but the people here in Boston.
So how did you get from one orchestra to the other? Did they call you, or did you think this was a leg up, or did you think it was time to go? How did it work?
Well, I've had the great, great fortune of never having to, I applied for jobs when I was 16, 17. I've never really applied for a job since I got the first job in Baltimore. That I applied for and wrote letters and got references. But subsequent to that, when I went to Minnesota and was my dad's boss for 2 years, and all those years of being denied allowances came right back at him because we had this ritual. He came into my office when I was running the Minnesota Orchestra every day and asked for a raise. I mean, I'd be over at his house on Sunday just, hitting a tennis ball with him. And so he didn't want to miss a day. So then once again, he obviously fully understood once I took that job, he was never going to get another raise. And he was well along in his career, so it wasn't even relevant. But that was our running ritual in Minnesota. So I got called by Ken Dayton, the founder of Target. And then in Detroit, I was called by a guy named Steve Miller, who was the vice chair of Chrysler. And I'll tell you a quick Detroit story. When I got called by Steve Miller and, Edsel Ford and a few other people, and I get there and I had my car from law school, which was a Honda Accord, kind of beat up. And so I went to visit Steve and Lee Iacocca, meeting Lee for the first time. And I drive up there. It was before they were in Auburn Hills. They were in Highland Park. And I drive up. Anybody knows Detroit geography? I drive up with my Honda Accord, and I go up to meet Mr. Iacocca. And, Lee, he says, you can't drive that car. I said, I know. I'm going to go get an American car, whatever. He says, no, you can't drive that car ever again. And I said, well, how do I get back to my office? And he said, here, let's get him. He put me in the elevator, went down, four, five, six, seven levels, and there we're in a garage. He says, pick a car. You don't own it, but you get to drive it. Insurance is all taken care of. And I said, but I have my car in your lot. He says, where would you like it to go? And I said, if you're going to give me a car, I don't need a car. My brother needs a car in Minneapolis. 3 days later, the truck drops the car off in Minneapolis. They never let me in Detroit go into another non-American-made car. Now Ford owned Volvo at that point and Jaguar, so there were other options. A lot of the Ford guys drove cars that weren't made in Dearborn or River Rouge or wherever.
Did Martha get a car?
No, Martha had a car already. So, she had an old Volvo, actually. So that was okay because Ford owned Volvo, so we could get away with that. But the Japanese cars were threatening to them, so forget the Accord.
Okay, so this is so interesting. Now, are orchestras like minor league ball, like Class C, Double A? I mean, does everybody know which orchestras are a little bit better or a lot better than the other orchestras?
Well, there is a hierarchy. We don't sit there and play each other, so it's not a competitive thing where you have, you form a league. And some of it goes by market size. It's not surprising. And some of it goes by, the Boston Symphony's been here 138 years. It takes, it's unlike a basketball team where you get three players and you buy three players and all of a sudden you're competitive. That's not the way orchestras work. Orchestras, we retire two or three people every year. We hire two or three people every year. So there's a natural attrition, but the culture remains pretty much intact. And so, the reality is there's the so-called Big Five, where the old establishment orchestras on the East Coast, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, of course, and then the big city in the Midwest, Chicago. And then, believe it or not, which Mr. Severinsen, who was the number two guy under Rockefeller at Standard Oil before Rockefeller left for New York. People forget, Standard Oil was originally a Cleveland company. And ultimately, that legacy, that incredible wealth created the possibility of an orchestra like the Cleveland Orchestra evolving in a city that obviously has probably been in decline for 30 years. Now recovering a little bit. But ultimately, those were the big five. And then, obviously, with the enormous infusion of wealth in California, it's not surprising that San Francisco and L.A. Became, good. And then you had traditions, you had the German emigres in Cincinnati. So they had a good orchestra in Cincinnati. And Minneapolis, an orchestra was created in 1903. And then you have this incredible spirit of philanthropy that, the Dayton family, the four brothers and their father who founded Dayton's, which became Target's. At one point they owned, the Dayton Hudson, they owned Hudson's in Detroit, they owned Marshall Fields in Chicago. So that fortune, created a possibility or led to the creation of a great orchestra in Minneapolis. And then finally in the South, you had, with the advent of air conditioning, you saw some economic expansion in Atlanta and Houston and Dallas. So those cities.
Okay, so let's get your trajectory correct here, Mark Volpe. You start down there in Baltimore, you have good crab cakes and all, and then you go to where? To
Minnesota.
Minnesota. And then you stay in Minnesota for a while, and then
just a couple of years. Yeah. I was there and I wasn't planning on leaving. That's my hometown. I get to manage the hometown orchestra. And then I got this intriguing, and you and I have had many conversations. I'm a little bit of a political junkie, and I got this incredible call from Detroit. And the job in Detroit was much different than being an orchestra manager. It was basically, we need to rejuvenate one more time. I had the Renaissance project that, of course, Henry Ford the Deuce, Henry Ford the Second, and Max Fisher and a few others certainly inspired, and yet Detroit still suffered. And so they kind of said, the orchestra is about to collapse. At that point, Martha and I were married, but we had no kids, so there's no little risk in terms of jeopardizing your kids' potential or possibility. And so ultimately, it was intriguing.
Did you have to check in with Martha on each of these changes?
Minnesota, I went before we were married, but Detroit, yeah. And I'll tell you, I'll never forget the first time we were going, they had this, it's one of the more horrible traditions in America, but the day before Halloween, it's called Devil's Night. And, Detroit had, the city itself had 2.5 million people. The metropolitan area is 4.5 million people, but 2.5 million people, which at that point, maybe 1 million people live now, it's like 700,000. So you had hundreds, frankly, thousands of vacant houses. And what they did the night before Halloween is all the 15, 16, 17-year-old kids would go and light these houses on fire.
Oh, my God.
So in a city with maybe 18 fire departments, there would be 600 fires going simultaneously.
Huh.
And we were there right before that, and then right after that. And I'm at the hall. They have a great hall that the Dodge family built for them. And they're bringing these big fire hoses, and they're wetting down the whole building. And again, no one would get that close. We had good security to the hall. But there were so many floating embers, burning embers, because there were so many burning buildings that all you need is something to stick and catch on fire. And so, to be proactive and preemptive, our guys were up on the roof with hoses. And that was our welcome to Detroit. Now, to the credit of Dennis Archer, he got rid of that. I mean, they got all the churches organized. They put thousands of people on the street, chasing the kids away from the big, big Baptist churches and some of the political groups organized. And so that tradition, thank God, ultimately died, and which is one of the better things that happened to Detroit. I was just back in Detroit doing a eulogy for one of the board members and one of our closest friends and was driving around Detroit. And it's exciting. Not only, that little catalyst that we provided, then a few other theaters got restored, and they built the baseball park for the Tigers and the football team. The Lions have new parks downtown, so everything's coming back downtown. Before that was probably one of the great examples of white flight. But it was fascinating. We were the last white couple to still be invited to Coleman Young's Thanksgiving, a name out of history, obviously. And I had great respect for Coleman Young, for everything he went through. And then Dennis, they had some very good mayors. And then obviously a week or two in the federal penitentiary, so the streak didn't continue. But nonetheless, they were great partners in trying to be part of the rejuvenation or resurgence of a very important city. People forget Detroit was the wealthiest city per capita in the United States in the 50s, early 50s.
Oh.
And of the top 30 market, it was last when I was there. Now we'll see what happens. Real estate's cheap, and so you start seeing artists coming into the lofts of the old warehouses and stuff. But it was fascinating, and so that, for me, I certainly went to a lot of concerts and stuff, but for me, that was about urban development and about, what you can do to the high school. I'll never forget, I'm talking totally out of school, coming from a Midwestern suburban background, and we're organizing this high school and, got the bond issue through, got some money from the state and from the city through a bond issue. And so we start designing this thing. And yeah, in my high school, there were probably two or three, young women that became pregnant. But in this high school, I think we ended up, I don't know if it was 20 or 24, we built a daycare center for like 25 kids. That's just, you had to do that. One of my points of pride, and pride's one of the seven deadly sins, so I say this with some hesitation, but that high school right now has probably the highest graduation rate and the highest percentage of kids, along with Cass Tech in Detroit, kids going to college of any high school in Detroit. By a factor of three or four.
Okay, I want to mention that we are talking to our friend Mark Volpe, recently named to the 237th class of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. It's an extraordinary achievement, and you deserve every bit of it. I hate to say that, but I do. So then you're done with Detroit. Now, when you said something before that really caught my ear. You said Henry Ford Deuce, meaning the second. Now, that's right. Funny. I mean, that's really funny. Is that the way they refer to the guy?
Oh, yeah. And Detroit, you would just hear the Deuce. Now, that's his history. I mean, now you're two generations beyond that. His son, Edsel, had a role in the company. Yeah, Edsel. Well, they kind of alternate between Henry and Edsel, every other generation. And so, Henry was the grandson. Henry the Deuce was the grandson because his father was Edsel, and that whole complicated relationship between Henry Ford Edsel. And then our kids occasionally were in play groups with Edsel's kids. Edsel lived close to where we lived. Bill Ford was on the other side. But Bill, they were cousins. And Bill was chairman of Ford. But now I think they've gone back to lay chairman. And, you know, the voting stock, you know, the company is still controlled by the family. Pretty big company to be controlled by one family. But that is still the case.
So I guess then comes the famous phone call from Yo-Yo, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're up to Yo-Yo. Now, before we talk about the world's greatest person, I mean, the world's greatest person, Yo-Yo Ma. Some people think it may be a little excessive of me, but I'm right. I'm absolutely right about
that. I'm not arguing.
Yeah, the world's greatest person. So before he calls you, what about when you leave places like Detroit, where you've made all these friends, the Edsels, the Deuce, and all the rest of them?
Well, the Deuce is gone by the time I got there.
Deuce is gone by that time. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, because the original Henry was a bit of a monster. We all know that. So I hope that didn't, you know, get down to the lower Deuces and all like that. You know what I mean?
No, actually, what, you know, if you look at before Gates and, of course, Warren Buffett, the largest foundation in the world.
That's right.
Was the Ford Foundation.
That's right. And many people think he's rolling over in his grave because he also became one of the most liberal foundations in the world.
Yeah, left the center, to say the least. That being said, you know, it's so interesting, and I don't mean to digress, but I'll do it anyway. I do mean to digress. Forgive me. You know, you look at what it took to create wealth back then. I mean, you look at the Fords, the DuPonts, the Mellons, the Rockefellers, the Roosevelts, the Bronfmans. It took decades and decades, and you know, the old robber barons, you know, and pre-income tax. But to the credit of all of them, you know, almost all, they might have been tyrants, they might have abused people, they might have had unsafe labor situations, but almost all those guys, I don't know if it was basically they faced their ultimate reckoning or whatever, they did good. Mm. They built Carnegie, you know, everyone knows in our business the hall, but much more important than a single hall.
Libraries.
The whole library system for America, 3,000 libraries, you know, and Rockefeller builds not just Rockefeller University, people forget, he built the University of Chicago, one of the great universities. The Mellons, they have this incredible foundation that continues to do incredible work. You know, the Kresge, unbelievable. All the capital projects, you know, that's the old Kmart money. Kellogg's, the, you know, foundation. And, you know, you have Gates and you have Buffett, but you have a lot of guys that when they, you know, now when they accumulate that enormous wealth and they do it in a couple years or, you know, I don't deny them their genius, but then they buy a sports franchise.
Yeah.
You look at what a difference that generation of robber barons, you know, of course, exploiting people and, of course, abusing all sorts of privilege.
And we don't even want to talk about the anti-Semitism from...
Henry Ford, of course. I mean, yeah. He and Lindbergh, God knows. Well, you had racial politics going there beyond the anti-Semitism with Henry Ford as well. But that aside, you know, maybe guilt kicked in or whatever was the motivating factor, and they did great stuff. And it'll be, I'm very curious, you know, in these tech fortunes, which, you know, you have Gates example, whether others will follow his lead and trying to do good. And Gates is concentrating a lot of his energy in Africa. There's a lot to be done in this country as well. And you hope, you know, beyond their kids' prep schools, that they see their way to make a difference in whether it be culture, whether it be education, medical research, social services. I mean, because this wealth is, the wealth was largely concentrated back then. We seem to be headed that direction once again, you know, for better in many instances, for worse.
We sure do. And we haven't even talked about you-know-who in this interview yet.
I was at the Kennedy Library event, and I marvel at President Obama, who made an absolutely compelling, moving, brilliant speech without ever, you know, mentioning a certain current president's name once.
mentioning the T word, the orange word.
I don't know if it was 25 minutes. It was. You know, he has such an understanding of cadence and you know, all of that stuff. He's a fantastic speaker. James actually sang along with our cellist Owen Young, and so it was nice to have symphony involvement in celebrating the 100th anniversary of.
Well, James, of course, made everybody cry, right? I mean,
he did. He did a wonderful speech, and then he actually impromptu, and this wasn't part of the program. They, you know, the election had just they sang the Marseillaise, you know.
Yeah.
At the end of their set of songs. So
that's why we love him so much. So okay, so the Boston Symphony, there is a triumvirate as far as I'm concerned. There is JT, who is, of course, as close to a Massachusetts hero and a Berkshire hero. There's Yo-Yo, of course, and there's you. And it is
there are a lot of other people.
No, I mean, there are, but, you know, these are the people, in my opinion, and I get to say it because I'm the moderator here, who really have been an extraordinary experience for us. But I want to go back to Yo-Yo calling you up. What did he say in order to recruit you for the Boston Symphony?
Well, it was an interesting call because I don't recall the verbatim words, but it was basically Ken Haas, a very lovely man, had a medical episode, and in spite of everyone's best efforts, it was clear he was not going to be able to resume his position here. And, you know, Yo-Yo obviously has his place out in the Berkshires in Tyringham. He also has a place here in Cambridge. He's one of the, a lot of artists are concentrated in New York, but he's made Boston his home, for many, many years. And it's likewise the Berkshires in the summer. And he said, Mark, you got it. It's the Boston, it's the Boston Symphony. And my initial reaction was, because we had wrapped up, we had built the office building, we built the car deck. I just, got the bonding through with four or five other people for the high school. And so that hadn't even broken ground. And I said, I can't leave right now. I mean, this work's too important. And I'm the one who kind of set this in motion and it would be inappropriate. And he kept on calling and called me 2, 3, 4 times. And then the call, I was actually fearing, because I don't know who said what to whom, because at that point, Tanglewood, as a school, was in a little bit of disarray, as you recall, 20 years ago, and they brought in Isaac Stern to help, because Isaac was one of the great thinkers and certainly one of the mentors to Yo-Yo, and Isaac gets me on the phone and says, I don't want you to lose your license or get fined, so I can't tell you exactly what he said. There are a few words that are part of the George Carlin list, so to speak. But ultimately, he said, are you, something crazy? It's the Boston Symphony. It's the most important orchestra in the United States, if not the world. You're coming. And I just talked to the board president, and lo and behold, 40 minutes later, the phone rings. And at that point, it's Nick Service. At that point, was board president, and two or three other calls, and said, you owe it to, yourself just to come look. Obviously, at that point, they don't know if they want me. They want to talk to me. And so it was first of, I think, 3 trips to Boston. It was intriguing, and I met first with board leaders and trustees and overseers, and for me, the 3 important constituencies are internal. I mean, you mentioned some incredibly important personalities, but I always think of internal constituencies as being the staff, of course, the orchestra, and the fiduciaries that make everything possible.
Do they get to vote on you, Mark? They get to vote on the musicians. They don't get to vote on you, though,
no,
right?
No. But I don't go into an orchestra unless the orchestra wants, the players want me. So I go to them. I sat with the combination of the Players Committee and Artistic Advisory Committee and sat with them for an hour or so. And they don't have a say. I'm hired by the, and I work directly for the board chair, but I'm not going into an orchestra. I mean, there are a few orchestras I would never, there is no other orchestra other than the Boston Symphony in my mind, but there are other orchestras that recruited me at different times, even before Boston, that are in that Big Five group, and their culture, their labor dynamic, their is just unhealthy, and life's too short. And so I'm not suggesting, they had a veto over it, but if I sensed they were hostile or angry or I didn't feel any kind of rhythm, with the players, I'm not coming. Because ultimately, if you look at our corporate name, I mean, Tanglewood is what makes us absolutely unique in the world, but our corporate name is Boston Symphony Orchestra. We are first and foremost an orchestra. And Tanglewood exists. We have this incredible, thank God for James and thank God for all the other people that are associated. And we love doing the graduations for the high school kids and stuff. But Tanglewood is, was built as the summer home of the Boston Symphony.
You bet. So Yo-Yo has you on the phone. Did you know Yo-Yo before that?
Oh, yeah. Yo-Yo was, a friend from days in Baltimore. I mean, he toured with us in Baltimore, went all over California, stuff with the Baltimore Symphony. Surly knew him in Minnesota, came to Detroit, saw some of what we were doing in Detroit. So I'd probably run into Yo-Yo 50 times before.
There's a new thing floating around the internet. I don't know if you've seen it. I'm sure you have. Of Yo-Yo playing the cello with his sister, who's playing the piano when he was 7 years old. And it's the most extraordinary thing you've ever seen in your life. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. No, but listen, I mean, a talented family. And he was destined. I mean, there's certain... it's like, I don't know, you're not as much of a sports buff as I, but if you see tape of LeBron James playing basketball when he's 11 or 12, that's like hearing Yo-Yo play cello when he was 7. I mean, you look at LeBron James 11 and I'm not saying he could play in the NBA at 11, but maybe. I mean, he was that physically superior. He was that dominant. And a guy never went to college because he went right from high school right to the pros. But ultimately, there are – it's like any other discipline. You know, it's Tiger Woods in his prime, not the Tiger Woods of today. I mean, you watch Tiger Woods on the Tonight Show at 4 years old. You know, I don't know how he got on the Tonight Show, but there he is with Johnny Carson. And you look at that swing and you go, oh, my God. You know, that's a talent that, you know, it's like bell curve. You know, that's the extreme end of the bell curve, someone that talented. And only if he gets his head screwed up is he not destined to be great. And Tiger was great until his head got screwed up. And obviously, you know, the rest is sort of history.
So now let's go to JT. You know, of all the great guys in the Berkshires and wonderful Kim and his great wife. And it's extraordinary what he does for the Boston Symphony, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, every July 4th for the past, I can't even remember how many years, he unbelievably donates the net proceeds. You know, he takes care of his band, as he should, because they're the best band in the world, and then takes a few other expenses, but basically takes the rest of it and gives it to the Tanglewood Music Center and the Tanglewood Festival.
Millions of dollars, right? I mean, really.
Yeah, over the years, yeah, of course, yeah. Millions of dollars.
What can you tell us about him that we don't know?
He's unbelievably intelligent. I mean, unbelievably politically engaged, thoughtful, considerate. I think Kim's been fantastic for him. I didn't know him that well, you know, before. I mean, I knew him professionally, of course, and I hired him in Detroit and hired him a few other places. Not that, you know, it's our privilege every time he shows up, but he's got two great kids who are doing great at Milton. God, I remember when they were born. I mean, I was at their wedding. I remember when they were, you know, it's kind of scary how fast time goes, especially the older you get, it seems to go faster and faster.
Not to
get melancholy, but you know, he's just one of the unique guys, and he inspires other pop people, and then he goes beyond pop. He transcends pop music, but to be generous. I mean, because these guys, you know, today's entertainers, you know, make staggering amounts of money. And you know, and you got guys like him and several others, Sting and a few others who are, you know, and then you see what, you know, Springsteen, they get involved in political causes, trying to do the right thing in terms of you know, sharing their talents and for a cause. And he gives away real money. In the professional sports world, they, you know, they get these appearance things and, you know, the Globe and all the newspapers go flying. You know, Tom Brady shows up someplace, they send 19 photographers. I don't mean to pick on the Globe because you know, every newspaper does it, including the Times. The cult of celebrity is ever more pervasive. But in the athletic world, you don't see these guys doing as much as like what James has done and others have done. You know, some of these guys who make $25 million a year, and frankly, candidly, subsidized by taxpayers because they're playing in stadiums all across the country that were built with either, you know, municipal financing or state appropriations. And obviously, that's part of the whole system that, you know, when people talk about classical music being elitist, I mean, you can come to a Tanglewood concert Friday night, a family of five or six, and it'll cost you, you know, $20, you know, because the parents pay, you know, $10 and the kids are free. And by the way, you can bring in your own food. So we're not going to try to sell you a $9 hot dog. You know, yeah. you go to a sports venue now, a family of four, family of five, forget it. It's okay. $300-$400 before you blink.
Okay, so I want to change because you've sort of brought me there. And that is it my, well, I love the fact, I love the music. I think that it's phenomenal. I do think it's the best orchestra in the world and keep saying so. But also the popular artist concerts are great. Now, is that something that had to be resisted? Is it something that had to be encouraged? Is that mixture a healthy one?
I think it's a healthy one. But what we've basically, you know, with a few exceptions, carved out is the 8 weeks that the BSO is in residence. And that I'm not saying we keep it entirely pure. We do Boston Symphony concerts. We do recitals. We do Boston Pops concerts. And then, of course, the school, you know, that incredible music center where we have 155 fellows from all over the world coming studying. And so that's sort of, the, you know, 95% of the focus during that 8 week period. But what, you know, we've decided and we're continue to invest, and we'll talk a little bit more about the physical plan of Tanglewood. You know, we continue to invest is certainly contractually the BSO players are there 8 weeks. But the weather's good out in the Berkshires, you know, 12, 13, 14 weeks. And ultimately, so what we've done is build out the shoulders. And you know, in June, you know, starting, you know, mid-June, we finish the graduations and go right into week, you know, several weekends of concerts. And then post-BSO, you know, the last week in August and maybe Labor Day, and we have, you know, a couple weeks of activities. So we've taken an 8-week or 9-week calendar and made it into a 12 or 13-week calendars. And on the shoulder seasons, the preponderance of the concerts we're promoting are popular artists, you know, and a whole range. You know, we have a few more that we haven't even announced. You know, we just announced Sting, you know, having Sting at Tanglewood, and you know, it's artists who I think resonate, you know, and have you know, have audiences that are going to be incredibly enthusiastic to be there, but also respectful of the venue. I mean, it's amazing.
Right. So, Mark Volke, you don't have crazy bands, but you do have the Joan Baez's and the others who so many of the regular orchestra listeners would love, would have grown
sure.
up with.
Well, so. Sure, and once in a while we skew a little younger than that, and yeah. with a few other types of bands. But the idea, you know, what I always find, you know, when you go to other sheds, you know, and mm-hmm. Tanglewood's unique, the 600 acres or 550 acres or whatever it is, 530 acres. But, you know, people are so respectful. You see them after popular artists, they're putting their garbage in the you know, sometimes 18,000 people, they overflow. And the next night, the you know, or by 10 o'clock the next morning, the place looks, you know, unbelievably clean again. And you go to other venues, and man, you know, I don't mean there's a venue somewhere close to Albany where you the lawn's gone. I mean, after, you know, the second or third rock show, I mean, it's completely different in terms of respect of the nature and the venue and the history and the atmosphere. And so I think Tanglewood's kind of unique in that sense that, you know, and the popular artists all know it. It's one of the, you know, the iconic venues in North America, and certainly one of the most beautiful settings. The Berkshire is hard to, you know, hard to compete with that. So,
Mark Volpe, I haven't fully understood. I have a limited intellectual capacity, but I haven't fully understood how it works with your conductors. Now, conductors are, not to use a bad term, but they are rock stars. I mean, they're very important. And so you've got, you know, James Levine, now Andreas Nelson. But they're not expected to be here all the time, right? Because they got worldwide commitments. They're around. Levine did the Metropolitan Opera till he couldn't anymore. So what is the relationship of the conductor with the business?
Well, they're hired as independent contractors. So the expectation is they're not going to be around for 52 weeks. Ultimately, Andres, who has embraced not just Boston, you know, in committing, you know, we have more than half the season now. He does more than half the concerts and certainly tours with the orchestra. And we're back in Japan in November with Andres. At Tanglewood, you know, it was complicated because he had pre-existing commitments. And so he had to work through those. And now, you know, for the foreseeable future, what's he doing? 10, 11, 12 concerts this summer. That's you know, more than, of course, Jimmy ever could conduct, and more than Seiji was certainly doing towards the end of his tenure. And so he's going to be, you know, in the Berkshire is good 4 or 5 weeks, working with the students and obviously conducting the BSO. I mean, what happened? When, you know, you go back to Koussevitzky and you think about geopolitics. At the end of the war, Tanglewood was about the only option, you know, in the world. Because, you know, Marshall hadn't done his Marshall Plan and rebuilt Europe, and Europe was in total disarray, the chaos post-war of Europe. And, of course, MacArthur in Japan hadn't really, you know, so Asia wasn't an option. And so all these incredible conductors, people like Koussevitzky, you know, and then this is before this little machine called the 747 was invented. So to get across, you know, the Atlantic Ocean, you had to go in a boat and you lost 5 days, 6 days, 7 days, depending on which direction you're headed and currents and all that. So ultimately, you know, there was a heyday of American orchestras where all especially, you know, the Hungarian Jewish conductors, because no one wanted to be in Europe, and a lot of them got out early. Toscanini, you know, that was the great Toscanini NBC era. Post-war, you know, Italy was in ruins, and Germany likewise. So everything was there. Now, what's happened in the last 20, 30 years is, you know, conductors, you know, well, first of all, they invented 747 and a few other big planes. And then all of a sudden, Europe got viable again. And that you know, a lot of the Western art music comes from Europe. Japan, which adores Western art music and has its own, you know, incredible indigenous music, became an economic powerhouse. And then after Japan, you know, you started seeing, when you ever see a middle class evolving, then all of a sudden you see musicians. So obviously you start seeing Japanese musicians like Seiji Ozawa, for one, come to America. And then all of a sudden the Korean economy got kicking. And all of a sudden you started seeing Koreans. And then, you know, post Cultural Revolution. Now, Cultural Revolution was a devastating period, obviously, in Chinese history. But after that, you know, in the last 10, 15 years, you know, we were in Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou with the orchestra. It's just, you know, it's just exploding. And again, orchestras are very much part of that as an emerging, you know, middle class and upper class in China.
So I wanted to ask about Seiji, who is, of course, another great hero. When I interviewed him, and I have had that opportunity, and he's a wonderful man, his English wasn't that good. What makes a great conductor have a relationship with an orchestra when his language facility isn't that great?
Well, rest assured, I don't mean to burst a bubble or two, but Seiji understood everything you ever said to him. I mean, and if he pretended not to, that's exactly what it was. It was pretending. And he was great. When he wanted to be understood, he could be understood. Now, obviously, you know, Andres, you know, he's got his first language is Latvian, his second language is Russian, speaks German, English. You know, he's got four, you know, very solid languages. You know, Seiji had Japanese and English, of course. But ultimately, most orchestras now rehearse, you know, with a few exceptions, in English. So almost all these guys speak English. But two, I mean, conductors who talk too much, you know, I mean, music transcends language. I mean, it's
so what do they do?
Itself.
So what do they do? In other words, what is it that they do? I mean, a lot of us see a guy up there with a baton, and he's moving the baton. What makes one better than the other?
Well, what you can't see is what happens in rehearsal unless you, I mean, you can come to any rehearsal you want, Alan, of course, but it doesn't apply to the rest of the public. So the reality is, because you're special, but the reality is, you know, through the, you know, the force of musical personality, musical intelligence, you know, they do the obvious things. They start, they end, they decide how loud, they decide how soft, they decide how fast, how slow, when to speed up, when to slow down, all those things. But that just all ties into the broader conception of the piece, the architecture. Every piece, not to get into building metaphors, has an architecture, has a structure, has form. I mean, to some of the new pieces, less so than the old form, but there is discipline. That you know, Mozart symphony, for the most part, always had four movements. They would be, you know, fast, you know, minuet, slow, fast, you know, and with different Italian markings, whatever. But you basically are the one, you know, that decides everything. You know, certainly in rehearsals, people can ask questions, people can make suggestions, but ultimately it's not a democracy. It is the ultimate, basically, I don't want to say totalitarian because that's such a pejorative connotation, but there's one person in charge. And that person has to deliver the goods and has to. And so the players know within 5-10 minutes whether it's real or not. I mean, and I mean 5-10 minutes of a rehearsal. They know whether there's a chemistry. They know whether, you know, the young conductors, we always coach not to talk too much. Because what the orchestra wants to see is they want to see something. They want to see what you're going to do. They want to, you know, get a sense of how you're going to conduct something. They, you know, typically they know the repertoire. You know, I mean, Andres is very aware that when he does a Brahms symphony, it's an orchestra that's played that same symphony with Seiji Ozawa, with Jim Levine, with Leonard Bernstein, with Bernard Haitink, with Christoph Andacchiani, with, you know, you name, with Kurt Mazur, you name the conductor they've done it with, you know. So you know, you basically, you know, Andres has an enormous regard for the orchestra and a great sense of humility, and so he's not going to sit there and try to teach. That being said, he's going to decide how fast, what the balance is, whether you want to have more clarinets and less viola, whether you want to have, you know, more cellos and lower strings instead of upper strings, you're balancing, and then you're going to decide exactly all of that, and it has to have a context, it has to have a logic, it has to have a structure. And so these guys are studying like crazy. And so, you have to have a historical context. I mean, Andres is always, you know, if he's doing Shostakovich, he's reading all of Shostakovich's correspondence. You know, he's reading everything that was happening, you know, during that war. Was this a period where he was afraid that Stalin was going to imprison him and torture him and send him to Siberia? Or is this a period where he was in favor and therefore could get away with a little bit more sarcasm or sardonic music? And, you, I mean, all this stuff. And, he, you know, Levine, likewise, he would go read all of Beethoven and Mozart's letters and what was going on in the world. You know, Russia and 41 and 43 and 44. Is very different than Russia of 37, where, you know, the purges, you know, the military and all that, or Russia of 50, Russia, or excuse me, Soviet Union post Stalin, you know, beginning of Khrushchev, you know, whatever, you know, and so you have to have a sense of what was going on, and you have to have a sense of history, you have to have a sense of what was going on in the world of poetry and architecture, because all these things overlap. You know, French impressionistic painting happened when French impressionistic music was happening, you know, Debussy, Ravel, you know, and Monet, you know, and so you have to have a sense of what was going on and how that all interconnects.
So interesting. So let me ask you this. You have a great assistant, or a great deputy, I should say, the artistic director, Tony Fogg, and he has to pick the soloists who are going to appear with Andreas Nelson and others. How much discussion is there about who's who and who will come?
Well, he certainly is a principal, and not to suggest I have nothing but the highest regard for Tony, but it's a little bit more involved in that, because you don't just pick a soloist and say to Andreas, you're working with this person. You know, that it doesn't work that way. Right. You call up, you know, Christoph Andacchiani and say, you're working with this person, or you call John Williams and say, we've hired this singer. No, you have, you know, he and I have everyone's phone numbers. He's the one that's on the point for all this, and he will call Andres, and, you know, we build a season, or we build a Tanguy season where we want a certain number of, yo-yo, of course, is a constant, and we want a certain number of violinists. Certain people come every year, certain people come every second or third year, a certain number of pianists, a certain number of specialty instruments, maybe a trumpet, maybe something else that's a little different than the norm. And you know, so, you know, rarely do we tell a conductor, you're working with this person. You know, typically it's a dialogue, and they'll give a list of four or five people they're interested in working with, and you know, then it becomes a big puzzle who's available and what date and all of that, and Tony has to coordinate all that. But it, you know, it tends to be, you know, again, Tony's the guy in the point, but it's not just one person. There's a whole series of people involved in, you know, selecting artists. Now, he's the one that negotiates contracts and facilitates all of that.
So let me ask you this. You know, you've explained conducting to me, and brilliantly, I think, but let's say one day a conductor who has rehearsed the orchestra already has a terrible migraine headache and can't go on. Now, we've known that has happened in the past. Could you, with your musicianship background, knowing that the orchestra had already been rehearsed, be given the baton and get up there and lead the orchestra?
The good news is we hire assistant conductors. We have two phenomenal assistant conductors who, there's at least one of them is in the hall for every minute of every rehearsal.
Oh,
who is there. They're young, aspiring conductors. Some of them have come through the Tanguy system. Good number of them, Ken David Mazur, Kurt Mazur's son, who's one of our assistants. And so they've been studying the scores. They've been talking, helping the conductor with the balances, you know, because the conductor's on the podium. Ken David is in the middle of the hall or in the balcony or in different parts of the hall advising.
Yes. Andres. I get that.
Those are the guys.
Yes, I get that.
You want on the podium if God forbid, Andres ever has a migraine.
I get that. But that wasn't the
You're
question.
Asking if I could do it?
Yeah.
I did it once in Baltimore.
No kidding.
I did it in a youth concert. And a tiny tots for little kids when both the conductor and the assistant conductor were driving together, first mistake, and got caught in can't remember, beltway traffic in Washington and Baltimore, between Washington and Baltimore. It was a very critical audience. They were between the ages of 3 and 5. And I ended up having to do the first 3 or 4 numbers with a small chamber orchestra. It wasn't a full orchestra, just to you know. Just
How'd
to
you
get
do?
Used to that. Well, you know, I was the general manager at that point. Put it this way, the general manager did not invite me back to conduct.
Oh, you mean you didn't invite yourself back to conduct?
I didn't invite myself back. I said, that's enough. The orchestra was quite amused. That goes both ways, you know, because I asked for volunteers from the orchestra before I put myself in that position, and no one in the orchestra was willing to stop. Cause we had 1,000 kids in this hall in Goucher College. And they were all, you know, you don't keep 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds waiting, God help you. And I went in front of the orchestra and said, who wants to conduct? And they all said, guess
well, you've been at the Boston Symphony for a while now. How many years?
20.
20 years. And you may remember the 2,000-year-old man at the very end. They asked him, you know, what he had to say, his goodbye remarks. And he said, well, I think something like, I'm here and they're not.
Come here. That's Carl Reiner, or is that Mel Brooks? Mel Brooks.
That's Mel Brooks. Yeah. So I'm here, and they're not. So your survival has been remarkable and deserved. I want to remind everybody that you have been recently named to the 237th class of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is an extraordinary achievement, no matter how much of a hard time I give you, Mark Volpe. And what are your humblest thoughts as we leave this interview about this honor? I mean, you know, it's extraordinary. Did you ever think you'd be there?
Well, I'm 237 classes behind John Adams, George Washington, and Thomas Jefferson. It's a very significant honor. I'm glad on the 237th ballot they considered me. The one thing I have been remiss in not saying is we have this incredible set of buildings, four pavilions that we're going to be breaking ground this summer, I'm sure. Yep. AMC, we'd love to have you be part of that. And we continue to invest, because I don't want to talk about myself, and Tanglewood, and we'll have a facility that will actually allow us to operate not just in 12 weeks, but for, you know, conceivably all 52 weeks. And that just reinforces what the Berkshires means to the Boston Symphony and what we hope to do in partnering with the various communities out there to have presence beyond the summer and early fall.
Yeah. But are you shy?
You've known me for how many years? You've known me for 20 years. The last thing I am is shy.
I think in a way you're a shy man. I do. I've seen you in situations where you are, I mean, you do a great job. I think my friend Pete Seeger was shy. I do. I think he was a shy man. I don't think you force yourself on other people. That's for sure.
I tell you where I get my real joy in life is not personal. It's nice and I do whatever and it's good. But being associated with institution, you mentioned the personalities, Yo-Yo, James, unbelievably generous, unbelievably wonderful spirits. But the institution's bigger than any single. It's bigger than Seiji. It's bigger than Andres. It's bigger than John Williams. It's bigger than Yo-Yo. It's a million billion times bigger than Mark Volpe. And that's the joy I get. The joy is being involved with the Boston Symphony, with Tanglewood, certainly with the Boston Pops, and an institution that touches millions of lives a million lives in person and millions of lives through media every year. And we have a content, we have a product, pardon the marketing vernacular, that makes people happy. And compared to what other companies sometimes make. And I don't mean to knock necessities, and we all need to function, but I always wanted to be in a position to be associated with a great institution that makes a difference. And certainly when Yo-Yo was talking to me way, way back 20 years ago, he made the case that Boston Symphony is such an institution.
We've been talking with our very good friend and mentor and helper, Mark Volpe, the managing director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Mark, you deserve every honor you get. I really, really mean that. And so thank you so much for taking all this time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.